KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Humans throw away tons and tons of non-degradable garbage every year. It's found its way to every corner of the globe, even to remote Midway Island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk with photographer Chris Jordan about the impact of all that garbage. Also coming up this hour, post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. The new state revenue forecast came out yesterday. It was good news for lawmakers in Olympia. They're in their second week of the second extra legislative session. Tax revenues were up more than $125 million over March, and that could spur our lawmakers to come up with a new budget sooner. Governor Jay Inslee's been warning if they don't finish their work by June 30th, we'll see at least a partial state government shutdown. I asked Governor Inslee earlier today how yesterday's revenue forecast is going to change the picture in Olympia.
Well, it helps. It's a small step on a long journey. It's $230 million to the good, which is helpful, but you've got to put that in context that we have a $4 billion hole in the budget. So it's way below 10% of even what we need for the long-term needs of the state. And so we've got more work to do. It is helpful. I hope that the legislators will come to the middle now and drop some of these ideological stumbling blocks that folks have put in the way and get a deal that actually finances schools, which is the paramount duty of our state. And I hope they'll be successful in the next few days.
You had an incredibly ambitious agenda when the legislature convened in January. You narrowed it. Schools and transportation were your priorities going into the first special session. It seems like we're going to be lucky if we see a budget at all and some school funding. What about that transportation package?
Well, I am committed lock, stock, and barrel to getting a transportation package, and I expect the legislators to vote on this. Look, I was just up at the Skagit River Bridge, which we got open at 6 o'clock this morning. We were very lucky in a sense because we were able to, because of the great work of a lot of iron workers and engineers and DOT people, they got it up within a month. But we know we've got a huge backlog of both maintenance and new construction that we need, and it's time for this state to move forward. You know, we want to build the next 777X. Boeing jet here in this state, and it's very important from our competitive position to improve our transportation situation so that we can continue to create jobs here in the state of Washington. So I'm committed to a transportation package. We have one. I've been working with legislators on a daily basis to get one, and as soon as this operating budget, in fact, I don't even want to wait, we hope people will vote before this is done, so that we can move this state forward.
A lot of, you mentioned the Skagit River Bridge, and it seems incredibly quick that the new, or at least the replacement span, the temporary replacement is in place. A lot of people expected that the collapse of that bridge would spur lawmakers to do something about transportation funding, and it seems like it really didn't.
Well, and I actually think there has been an increasing likelihood that we can improve transportation this year in the state capitol. I have more and more people understanding the importance of this. But it really, you know, what happened on the Skagit River, we knew before that bridge collapsed that we had a transportation infrastructure problem, and we know afterwards that it's really whether or not that bridge went down is immaterial. We know that we've got a 520 bridge we've got to finance to complete. We know we need a new highway in 167 to actually build a highway after decades of waiting. We know we need a new bridge across the Columbia River. We know these things already. It should be obvious. We are a growing state. We're attracting people here because we're a dynamic economy. But you can't continue to have a dynamic economy when the basic arterial, the light that carries the lifeblood of freight and commuters, deteriorates, and it is. And people are experiencing this with increased commute times, certainly in the Puget Sound Basin, and deteriorating roads across the state. So we have a very sound package which will help on a very multimodal system to help single-occupancy cars, buses, light rail, bikes, you name it, because we need multiple ways for people to get to and from work in the morning. And we've got to have the legislature step up to the plate and fulfill their responsibilities, which is to help lead this state to keep its economy growing. So, no, I'm very committed to this, and we'll be talking about that in the next few days.
Well, Governor, a lot of people were surprised over the weekend to see Seattle Times and I'm sure other newspapers report that the first special legislative session resulted in not one bill being passed. And at a cost to the taxpayers. And I was wondering, from your vantage point, is it philosophy that caused the gridlock?
Well, look, everyone is going to have their perspective about who's responsible for this. The 30,000 foot level will simply say people did not come to the middle. They did not reach compromise. Now, we finally succeeded in having some of our Republican colleagues relent and finally closed this loophole at 1:30 in the morning, Friday morning,
right,
just in the nick of time, so that $160 million would not be lost in the Educational Legacy Trust Fund to give multi-million dollar estates tax relief. So that was a big stumbling block that was finally removed last week, and I'm glad that my Republican colleagues finally were willing to do that. There are some other things that have been stumbling blocks, which you might consider ideological. One of the Senate Majority Caucus has insisted on what I would consider some ideologically driven changes in a variety of areas that are really not necessary on a budget for a budgetary reason. And I, in contrast, frankly, have removed some of the more contentious issues from consideration to focus on the budget. Look, we got to focus on the main task before us, which is the budget, which is to provide our kids an education. And we've got to put other things aside. And I've been urging legislators to do that. The good news is I think that's happening now. I think that we have a good chance of success here in the next few days because people have finally dropped some of these ideological insistence that they've had before we get down to business and get a budget. I think the ice is breaking in that regard, and it's long overdue. Now, if we get some of these things done at the end of the session, we are working on an impaired driver bill. I'm still working on this transportation package. That's extremely important. And if we get these things done at the end, we'll look back at it with some success.
And a last question. Yesterday, the Army Corps of Engineers told a congressional subcommittee it would not consider global climate change in making its decision about the siting of coal terminals here in Washington and Oregon. What was your response to that decision?
Well, I don't agree with it. I sent a letter to the Corps asking that they consider certainly the transportation impacts across the state of Washington, which could be quite profound. When you have these almost two-mile-long trains bisecting small towns, you know, up in Burlington, we just got the bridge up at 6 o'clock this morning on I-5, and then to cut other towns up and down the I-5 corridor with these long coal trains, it's something that really has to be considered. So that's a very disappointing decision. We also will be considering the health impacts associated with pollution associated with this product, because we get the pollution wherever it is, wherever this coal is burned, we get the pollution. It ends up in Puget Sound. It ends up changing the patterns of climate. So we've got to have a much deeper, much broader assessment in looking at this project.
That was not a definitive decision that the trains would pass through, that the terminals would open, correct?
No. This was a decision of what they would be reporting on in their environmental impact statements. Now, the state of Washington has a separate system of protecting the health of Washingtonians, and we will, in that state system, we will be evaluating the transportation impacts across the state and the full scope of health impacts on Washingtonians as well. So even if the federal government doesn't do its job on this, we intend to do so in full compliance with the law. We intend to follow the law to the letter and make sure that Washingtonians' health is protected.
Are you saying that should they decide to go ahead with it at the federal level, the state can override that decision?
The state can do its own environmental assessment under SEPA, under our State and Environmental Protection Act. So we have the ability through our Department of Ecology and through our appropriate permitting authorities to evaluate the health impacts of this proposal. Now, in saying this is not a decision on the proposal. It's only a decision on what we will consider in this decision. We're going to be following the law, which does require us to, in the state of Washington, under state law, to look at these health and transportation impacts. So we'll be able to do it on a state basis, even if the Army Corps does not come through. But we will continue to urge them to have a broader assessment.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee, I spoke with him earlier this morning. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
$67,000 mushroom clouds, 260,000 car keys, 400,000 plastic bottle caps. These are all elements in the artwork of Seattle-based photographer Chris Jordan. But his work isn't really about mushroom clouds or car keys or bottle caps. It's about the human race and the choices we make. We're going to talk with Chris Jordan for 1,200 seconds, just 53 seconds from now.
Support for KUOW comes from Specialty Natural Medicine, with more than 40 years combined experience in natural and conventional treatment, specializing in food allergy resolution, family, and digestive medicine. Learn more at specialtynaturalmedicine.com.
55 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy, a little rainy as well. Forecast says chance of showers through the day. We're supposed to see a little bit of sun this afternoon, and they think we're going to hit 70 degrees. It's 9:18. I'm Bernard Ouellette. One in three of our combat soldiers suffers from traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress as a result of their time in the service. How do we try to understand what they're going through and what kind of help are they getting? We're going to find out in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Midway Island is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, as its name might sound. It's thousands of miles from the nearest continent. But Midway has not escaped the impact of human consumption and waste. Seattle-based photographer Chris Jordan has traveled to Midway many times to document the albatross that lived there. The result of his visits is a film that will be released later this year, they hope, at the Toronto International Film Festival. Chris Jordan is in our studios today. It's very wonderful to have you here. And I'm wondering what you knew about Midway before you made your first trip there.
When I thought of Midway the first time, I thought of it as the place where the Battle of Midway happened in World War II. And I knew that it was a small island in the very middle of the Pacific Ocean. But other than that, it barely crossed my consciousness.
I had to look at a map. It's actually sort of near Hawaii, if it's near anything. Is that the nearest group of islands to it?
Yeah, other than Hawaii, it's about 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii, and other than that, it's 3,000 miles to the nearest continent in any direction.
So it's just sitting out in the middle of there. Now, you have built your career photographing the impact of human beings on our planet. Most of that work has been done on the continents where human beings are. So what got you to Midway in the first place?
Well, for many years, I've been interested in kind of facing the horror and the enormity of our mass consumption, mm-hmm. and I did this long series that I call Running the Numbers, which is building these large scale conceptual artworks that are digitally constructed to show the total number of cell phones that we throw out or the total number of plastic bottles that we use, but through that whole series, I was always a little bit dissatisfied with the kind of abstractness of the conceptual process, because there's just something about a photograph, you know, a photograph of something real in the real world. And I always craved to be able to take a photograph specifically of the Pacific Garbage Patch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a bunch of studying of it, and I imagined that I could go on a boat into the middle of this thing that I had heard was a floating island of garbage twice the size of Texas. I imagine going in a boat to the middle of it and seeing horizon to horizon plastic trash. And when I started talking with scientists, I learned that there is no Pacific garbage patch like that, that the plastic is spread out over thousands of miles of ocean. It doesn't actually swirl all to the middle the way people think. It spreads out.
So essentially, the Pacific Ocean is full of trash.
They say there are 10 million tons of plastic in the Pacific Ocean, but if you take a boat to the middle of what we call the Pacific Garbage Patch, all you see is the wide open blue Pacific. And so as a photographer, You know, I'm stuck again in this place where this profoundly important issue is invisible to us. Mm-hmm. There's no way to take a photograph of it. And one day I was in a meeting with a bunch of scientists, and I was lamenting that very thing and saying, I want to take a photograph of the Pacific Garbage Patch. And this young woman who's a biologist turned to me and she said, well, you want to take a photograph of the Pacific Garbage Patch, go to Midway Island and look inside the stomachs of dead baby albatrosses.
Which you did. Aside from the Battle of Midway and the fact that this is in the middle of the Pacific, do people live on Midway Island? What is there?
Well, it's a tiny island. It's never had like an indigenous population, but it has been inhabited for quite a few years because, you know, if it was a military base during World War II, and then ever since then, it was a sort of semi-secret military base during the whole Cold War. They had a vast radar installation there that tracked the submarines, all the Russian submarines. And so there are actually 5,000 people living on this tiny island for several decades. And only very recently, the military base was decommissioned, and now it's a Marine National Monument.
And how many albatross come through there every year?
Oh, there's a population of 1 million Laysan albatrosses on this tiny island. And if you divide the square footage of the island by the number of albatrosses, it's a mated pair of albatrosses for every square meter of the island.
You described it as sort of when they come and stop there, I'm not sure if they're resting or nesting or maybe both there, that it's like an outdoor rock festival. You know, albatrosses everywhere.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, there are as many albatrosses on the ground as you know, in a concert in the park. You know, like you have to carefully weave your way in between them. And the most astonishing thing of all is they've lived there for 4 million years, and they've never had a predator. There's nothing that's ever eaten albatrosses or their eggs, and so they have no fear response to us. You can literally walk right up to them and put your face so close to them that they could peck your face if they wanted to, and they aren't afraid.
And so they don't peck your face, in other words.
They don't. Well, you have to be a little careful. If you walk up and sort of loom over them, then they get scared. But otherwise, you know, if you're a little careful and just sort of move in slowly, and you can get so close to them. And they're these magnificent, huge, gorgeous creatures like eagles. Like imagine if you could get so close to an eagle that your face is 5 inches away and you could just look at it and really experience it from that close. It's like that there.
Chris Jordan is a Seattle-based photographer, and his latest project, which I think was many years in the making, is called Midway, culminating in his first film that's going to be released this fall. Well, so it's one thing to see the birds from the outside, and the pictures are a little fuzzy. Do they call them chicks? Albatross chicks. They look cute. There's big birds. Why would anybody think to look in their stomachs, and how often do you get the chance to look at the internal parts of a bird?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's when you kind of face the horror of what's happening there. I mean, on the ground are the decaying carcasses of tens of thousands of dead ones, and they decompose pretty quickly because it's a tropical place. You know, it rains a lot, and there's all these bugs that eat the remains. And so within just a few weeks after an albatross dies, all the feathers are gone, all the connective tissue is gone, and what's left is a skeleton of the bird, and where its stomach was is a pile of plastic, like a couple handfuls. Maybe 22 bottle caps, 3 cigarette lighters, a toothbrush, and 150 more little shards of plastic.
That's kind of astonishing to me. So do they die of ingesting this plastic, or is that just something that you see when they are dead?
Well, it's scientifically, it's really kind of annoying and frustrating to talk to the scientists who are studying it because it's so hard to determine how a particular bird dies. You know, so a bird might be filled with plastic and it tries to fly out to sea and it's weak. Its stomach is punctured by a hypodermic needle that's in there, but the bird drowns and so washes up drowned. And so the cause of death is drowning. But then you open up the bird and see that it had two baseballs you know, the volume of two baseballs worth of plastic inside his stomach, and it's obvious that the plastic killed it. But so the only thing the scientists are willing to say is that the plastic inside them is increasing their mortality by an unknown factor. But to anyone who goes there and sees the number of dead birds on the ground and how much plastic is inside them, it's obvious that the plastic is having a huge effect on them.
You went, I'm assuming, attending to go for one long period of time. How long were you there that first visit?
First time I went there in 2009, in the fall of 2009, I went there for just 2 weeks. And I thought it was just going to be to go there and photograph the plastic-filled dead ones. And so we went at a time of year when there were no live albatrosses on the island.
Mm. Just carcasses.
Yeah, tens of thousands of carcasses on the ground. And it was such a stunning experience to go back the second time and to meet a million of these incredibly gorgeous, graceful beings.
Why did you go back?
Why
go back?
Well, the photographs that I took from the first trip, I put them on my website, mm-hmm. and was astonished that they reached a vast audience around the world. I wasn't expecting that at all. I thought the project was going to totally bomb.
Why?
Well, I had a few people say before I went out there, you know, I was mustering the resources to go, and it was going to be a really expensive process.
Yeah.
And I had a few people say, you know, the art world is not exactly clamoring for photographs of dead birds filled with plastic. And the kind of intention behind it was to witness a tragedy. And I had done that fairly recently before that when I went down to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And that project totally bombed as well. Hmm. You know, it's just there's not a lot of public interest. It's hard to face the realities of our time. And so that's what I was expecting. And the project, I had to hire an assistant to just answer my email. There's so many thousands of emails came pouring in from all over the world about the birds filled with plastic. And it broke my heart because a lot of people wrote that had exactly the opposite response that I wished. They wrote messages of hopelessness and despair and trauma. And I realized that's how I felt too. And I didn't know what to do because I don't want to fall into a place of hopelessness. Like my work is, I'm trying to face the realities of our time and come out the other side in a place where I'm inspired and I feel empowered. And I didn't feel that coming back from Midway. I felt hopeless. I think everyone on my team was traumatized by what we saw.
Yeah.
And so I went to the person whose work I'd been reading for years and years, who really knows how to witness. She's been writing about witnessing, our national treasure, Terry Tempest Williams. And I took the photographs with me and I said, I feel hopeless. And she looked at the work and she had this deep insight. She said, the story's not over. Hmm. She said, you have to go back. She said, I don't know what you're going to see there, but if you went into the fire and you burned up, that means you just haven't gone all the way through the fire yet. She said, you have to go back. And that began this long process.
So did you intentionally pick a time where the birds would actually be there, or how did you... How do you even know when the albatrosses land on Midway Island?
Well, there's a whole yearly life cycle that the biologists understand really well. So they can tell you, in any month, they can tell you exactly what's going to be happening there. And strangely enough, I chose the second time I went, I wanted to go there when the birds were actually dying.
Oh.
Because there's a season when the parents... Basically, the parents feed their chicks for about 6 months. The chicks hatch in February, and the parents feed them, and they feed them, and they feed them all the way through the spring. And by July, the chicks are filled with plastic. And that's when they fledge. They look like teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, one day, the parents stop feeding them, and then the birds, the teenagers, take off flying out over the sea. And so in July, they're dying by the thousands because they're filled with plastic, and I want to be there. And my idea of going further into the fire was to actually witness the dying, and And we did. That's the second time we went there. It was in July of 2010. And it was a profound experience to be there and see these birds as they breathe their last breath, you know, to hold them and feel their quivering bodies stop quivering. And at the same time, there were still lots of adults in the island, and we got to see them doing their dances and zooming in the air when the wind blows across the island.
I'm still feeling like I'm in the fire here, though. I mean, I'm witnessing this secondhand through your story. So are you feeling some sense of hope at this point, or are you still in that sense of state of hopelessness and despair?
Well, you know, that's kind of the question that has motivated this whole project. It was a question that was asked of me by a school teacher in Australia a couple of years back, and this is what took me to Terry Tempest Williams, is the question, how do we get to hope from here?
Mm-hmm.
And when I was asked that, that question just really rang the temple bell for me. How do we get to hope from here? I think it's a question that we're kind of holding collectively. And so I started looking, like, what is hope? Like, if hope is the thing we all want to get to, like, what is that thing we're trying to get to? And it's really interesting when you start looking at hope. I mean, hope for me ends up being a kind of puff of smoke.
Hmm.
It's like Terry likes to say, hope is for hostages. It's a disempowered mind state.
Yeah.
It's like hope is something that we wish for that's out of our control. Like, I hope the world doesn't get hit by an asteroid, you know, or I hope I live till I'm old. But we don't hope for the things we can control. You know, my son Emerson likes to come home from school and make a joke to me about that. He says, I hope I do my homework today. You know, it's like we don't hope for the things we can control ourselves.
Sure.
And so if as a culture we're trying to get to hope, I think maybe we've got our compass set to the wrong star. And what I discovered is it's possible to let go of hope and to still be alive. You know, it's like we don't have to be hopeful to still act. And I think it's almost like a semantic thing. I think the thing we really want is not hope, but it's love. I think we want to return to a state of love with ourselves and with each other and with the miracle of our world. And I've discovered on Midway that witnessing the horror and feeling what I feel, which is a tremendously deep grief for what's happening, not only to those birds, but kind of as a symbol for the destruction that's happening all over our world. When I allow myself to really feel that, then I remember the love that I'm made of, that we're all made of,
because mm-hmm.
that's what grief is. Grief is an experience of love for something that we're losing or that we've lost. At the very beginning of Dante's Inferno, there's a beautiful piece of wisdom where he walks through the gates. You know, he's about to walk through the fire, and he has to go through the gates. And it says, abandon hope, ye who enter here. And the wisdom there, it's not abandon hope in favor of being hopeless. It's abandon the sort of passiveness of hope in favor of taking control of one's own destiny.
You clearly went back more than one time. You've made a film about this, but this sounds like a complete transformation of the way you view your purpose as an artist and I suppose an archivist of what's happening. So where do you go next from Midway, from your experience there in your career?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one way I can answer that is I remember when my son was born, I was with his mother, Helena, and some friends came in. She was just holding him. It was just hours previously. And someone said, are you thinking about having another child? And she looked over and she said, let's let the episiotomy heal before we start talking about that. So I'm not sure where next. But, you know, I mean, the gift of the story of Midway that I feel like has been given to me is it's such an amazing story and so coincidental and kind of mythic on so many levels that it's hard for me to imagine that something like that will ever come to me again.
Yeah, I mean, in listening to you describe it, I think we're lucky if we have something that profound in our lives, because it changed you not as an artist only, but as a human, it sounds like. Your whole awareness of why you're here on Earth was changed by this experience that was work-related.
Yeah, I've really learned that there's something about witnessing that it deepens our capacity. Like, it opens us and deepens us.
So people can go to your Chris Jordan, to his website. You can see the still photographs, and there's a little clip of the film that will be released in the fall. I'm assuming, since you live in Seattle part of the time, that we will get to see it here, as well as having to travel to Toronto or wherever you're going to premiere it.
Yes, I sure hope so. I'm so looking forward to sharing it here. And also tonight at my talk at Town Hall.
Are you going to show the film?
I'm going to be showing the trailer and then some short clips from the film. And then I'll also be showing a whole lot of photographs that have previously not been released.
Seattle-based photographer Chris Jordan's new film about Midway, as you heard, will premiere later this year, but you can get, I suppose, what we call a sneak peek. That's what the industry calls it. Tonight at 7:30 when he speaks at Town Hall Seattle. That talk is actually part of a celebration of the organization's Sightlines 20th anniversary, and I believe you're the kickoff lecture for that. So that's this evening. Chris Jordan, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
Art, science, the ecology, how human activities impact the Earth, what it means to be human. That conversation we just heard with local photographer Chris Jordan is a good example of how every day KUOW takes you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper perspective on important issues. Allow me to suggest that now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. On June 30th, we close the books on our current fiscal year. Gifts made before June 30th ensure KUOW continues to provide you with programs that nurture your knowledge all year long. Please mail in your gift today or go online, kuow.org, and thanks. Understanding the psychological wounds of our soldiers in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Metropolitan Market's Local Tastes Best event. Metropolitan Market's butchers are in store 7 days a week to provide custom cuts of all prime and choice grade Northwest beef. More about local ranchers and varieties of Northwest beef at metropolitan-market.com.
55 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. We've had a few showers this morning, and it's a continuing chance of rain through the day. Although we do expect to see some sun this afternoon as well, and we're going to reach 70 degrees. It's 9:39. I'm Bernard Ouellette. In the news today, Afghan President Karzai is now rejecting peace talks with the U.S. and the Taliban. We'll get caught up on what's happening with that in about 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. As the active wars in the Middle East start to wind down, we've heard a lot about the aftermath of combat, including something called post-traumatic stress. You may have heard post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic stress syndrome. General Pete Corelli has seen PTS and traumatic brain injuries firsthand. He served two tours as a combat commander in Iraq, and he now heads an organization based in Seattle called One Mind Research. It aims to erase the stigma that service members and vets who suffer from either PTS or brain injuries face. And General Pete Corelli joins us. I'm going to call you General, even though you're retired, right?
You can call me whatever you want.
As I just said, we have heard post-traumatic stress referred to as post-traumatic stress disorder or syndrome in the past, but you call it post-traumatic stress. Why?
I believe the disorder is a barrier to care. If you tell a 19 to 24-year-old young man or woman that they go to the doctor and are branded with a disorder, many of them won't go and get the help that they need, and they self-medicate. I also think it's a misnomer. I think something happens to the brain. I think it's an injury to the brain. I think that's where research is going. And, you know, a majority of the research that's been done on people with post-traumatic stress are women who are sexually assaulted, and I find it almost offensive. I find it offensive to look at a woman who has a reaction to that and indicate that she has a disorder.
And this is a similar thing that a service member or a vet has from the experience.
It's a traumatic event that someone goes through.
This is something that in World War One they used to call it shell shock, right?
They used to call it shell shock. They've called it operational exhaustion, battle fatigue, post-traumatic stress. Audie Murphy, one of the most decorated soldier out of World War II, spent the latter part of his life going around to veterans organizations because he suffered from what we call post-traumatic stress today, trying to get veterans to go in and get the help that they needed.
You spent most of your career in active service in various parts of the world. When did you first see this in a soldier that you were serving with?
Well, I saw it, but I didn't know what it was.
Oh.
In the 2 years I was in Iraq, I knew that when I had a platoon that had a bad day, that I had combat stress professionals that I needed to get to their location to help them. I knew what my football coach had told me about traumatic brain injury, that all you had to do when you had head trauma was to shake it off and get back in the game. But it wasn't until I came back and I was briefed by our medical command of the numbers that we had of our most seriously wounded. In 2008, that was 36% of our most seriously wounded with a single disqualifying injury of 30% or greater, as recognized by the VA, had traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. When I left as vice, that number was 67%. And if you want to compare that, 10% have lost an arm, a leg, or multiple limbs.
What is the relationship specifically between a traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress?
There is what the doctors call a comorbidity. They share many of the same symptoms. And we are seeing, as research progresses, that there's much more that these two problems share than are different about them. So that's where research is going. And we really saw a high number of our soldiers with traumatic brain injury also had post-traumatic stress. We thought somewhere in the vicinity of 60 to 80%.
So a traumatic brain injury is you get a hit to the head or
a trauma of some kind.
And it can be anywhere in the brain, correct?
It can be anywhere on the head.
Anywhere on the head. And you can see it, right, if you do a brain scan?
Well, there are ways that using something called positron emission tomography, which is a way of imaging the brain, that we can show and see a concussed brain. And that's really critical. That helps us beat back the stigma associated with these things and made all our football coaches a long time ago. We were able to get past what they used to tell us.
Well, in fact, high school athletes now, you have to sign a form that you realize that you could get a concussion. So can you see an injury in the brain with anybody who is experiencing post-traumatic stress?
No, we can't yet, but we're getting very close. And there's some people who indicate that they have been able to image post-traumatic stress and actually see physical changes in the brain. But we don't have that as a proved diagnostic at this time, which is absolutely critical. The only way to diagnose post-traumatic stress is through 14 questions that are part of what used to be DSM-4, now DSM-5, which is a psychiatric manual that lays this all out. And you ask a person these 14 questions, and then the person making that diagnosis based on their answers makes a determination whether they have post-traumatic stress or not. I think most people think that that's a definitive diagnosis, and I would argue that we really don't know the extent of this problem. We don't know if we are overestimating the number of people with it or underestimating, because we don't have good diagnostics.
We're talking with General Pete Corelli, who is spending his post-military life working trying to erase the stigma that does accompany traumatic brain injuries, which I'm now going to call TMI, and post-traumatic stress, PTS, mostly just for shorthand's sake. What we've heard a lot about suicide rates in veterans who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Is there a link between those sorts of reports and PTS or TBI diagnoses?
We don't have anything definitive that allows to say that with certainty, but I think that most researchers and people who study the suicide problem believe that that is in fact the case, that there is a link, that all these things are linked. We tend to think of these as individual diseases that are kind of stovepiped, but what we're seeing is tremendous similarities between these diseases. We know at least we think we know right now, there's a connection between post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS, that they all share some commonality. And one of the things we're trying to do with One Mind is that we're trying to break down these stovepipes and get people to think of these as injuries or diseases of the brain rather than put them in a nice, neat box and try to solve those problems. And we think that that's key because researchers need to share their data because these are really, really tough problems.
How would you go about, I mean, if with the 14 questions, how would you know to even ask somebody these 14 questions?
The questions are in the manual.
But, I mean, are there specific symptoms that somebody would exhibit that you would ask
them?
That's
exactly right. People come in with specific symptoms. They can be irritability, periods of very high stress, individuals who have headaches, sleeplessness, partner aggression. One of the key ones you have to look for is an individual who abuses alcohol or drugs. And that's an attempt in many instances to self-medicate. People who have post-traumatic stress based on whatever it is that causes them to have a problem with this, based on some kind of an event occurs, will go into a period of high arousal for anywhere from 1 hour to 6 hours.
We heard a lot about this recently when Army Staff Sergeant Bales pled guilty to 16 counts of murder in Afghanistan. And his attorney says that he went into combat too many times. And, you know, first tour, he was fine. Second tour, okay. Third tour, something happened that caused him to snap. This is an extreme example, obviously. But what we're looking at is intangible effects or cumulative effects of soldiers in combat. So is it a length of time in combat that might affect this, the experience?
There are all kinds of reasons, and we have to be very, very careful because in talking about this and shining the spotlight on it, there's a tendency to walk away thinking anybody who's deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan has post-traumatic stress, and that just is not the case. The numbers are really quite low. That's not to say it's not a problem, but the fact of the matter is many people go over and spend multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and have none of these issues. And I think research is showing us that much of this is genetically. I've had research scientists tell me that you can have a 5'5" female that weighs 120 pounds get hit on the head and then have a 6'8" male get hit on the head at the same place with the same amount of force, and the female does not have a concussion, and the male does, because some people are genetically predisposed, we think, to be concussed. So as we try to unlock the secrets of the brain, we're learning more and more about how all these things happen.
Are there obviously, if you have a concussion, there's an immediate physical evidence and you can help treat that.
They're not easily diagnosed.
I was going to ask, is there a lag time in which certain symptoms might emerge that you don't see immediately?
Well, the really important thing for us to do is to find some kind of a biomarker. And we are looking very, very hard. When I was in the Army, we were looking very, very hard to find a blood biomarker, something that you could, let's say you had a young child playing a contact sport and it was believed that they were in a concussive event, that they could be pulled to the sidelines. You could use an assay machine, not unlike what a diabetic uses to check blood sugar. You could prick their finger, get that sample of blood, and based on the presence of a blood biomarker, be able to tell whether that person was concussed or not. That would be a huge step forward. And when you understand that, when you have that, that makes moving from the diagnosis to the treatment much, much easier.
Because otherwise, we're just looking at people who externally look fine.
Yeah, you know, we have a tendency, and that's the problem with diseases of the brain. We go to the doctor and our leg hurts, and the doctor takes an x-ray and says, your leg's broken or your leg's not broken. We have that, you know, that certainty of diagnosis. That's not the case with the diseases of the brain. There are no blood biomarkers we know of. We are making tremendous improvements in imaging that allow us to take care of the severely injured traumatic brain injury patient with either penetrating or severe traumatic brain injury. But when we talk about mild and moderate traumatic brain injury, the kind of traumatic brain injury most associated with, let's say, contact sports, mm-hmm. it is extremely difficult with any certainty to be able to diagnose immediately.
Is that where the stigma comes in, that it's externally invisible?
Yeah, I think that the brain makes us who we are. And I think that we do not want to admit to ourselves many times that we are suffering from these problems. And when you realize that one out of three, one out of four people will suffer some form of brain disorder in their life, we've really got to get at this problem. This is a huge, huge public health problem.
We were talking about the DSM-5, which is a mental health diagnosis manual. Mental illness in and of itself, whether it's PTS, traumatic brain injury, or schizophrenia, has its own stigma in this country. And then it seems that what you're talking about is the compounding of it. You might not exhibit specific symptoms. You might not have a textbook diagnosis.
And that's exactly right. And that's what I think keeps so many people out of treatment. You know, people do not want to be branded with the fact that they have a disorder, that they have a problem with their brain, that they, in fact, might be violent or not a good coworker in the workplace. So they find other ways to take care of themselves. And what we really need to do is we need to get people into treatment. But we need to also understand, and I think that this is very, very important, is that we need to make the investment in the research required to get answers. We just don't have the answers today. And that's so important for people to understand because, again, they're so used to going into their doctor and their doctor being able to tell them what is the matter. When I left the Army, they took 11 vials of blood in my final physical, okay? But that was to check on my body from the neck down. Not a single one of those vials of blood that went through my blood chemistry was used to see if I had any issues when it came to my brain.
Did you?
You know, that's a great question, and I've thought a lot about that. I don't believe that I did after my two tours in Iraq, and I believe that I'm like the large majority of soldiers who went over there, experienced things that no human being should ever have to experience, but I was resilient enough to not have the problems. I didn't suffer or go through some of the things. Horrendous things that soldiers have had to go through over there. So that's not to say that I might not, but I don't believe I did, but I am very proud of the senior officers that have come out and indicated that they have gotten help for some of the problems that they had.
Well, as you mentioned, you saw things that people, most civilians, don't have to witness, and some of us don't even read about or look at photos of. What health services exist for active service people or vets who come back and A, face up to the fact that they might have this problem, and B, want to seek some help?
In my role with One Mind, I'm working very, very closely with Level 1 trauma centers, and one of those is University of California at San Francisco and also here at Harborview.
Right.
The doctors there tell me that when they get a patient in with traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress, and when they release them from the hospital, there is no support system like the VA. Now, you know, we can criticize the VA all we want to criticize the VA, but at least for a majority of soldiers who suffer these problems, there is a support system. There is some place for them to go. What I really worry about is we tend to associate these injuries only with soldiers. 3.4 million Americans suffer head trauma every single year. 265,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines over almost 13 years of war have a diagnosis of traumatic brain injury. 265,000 over 13 years versus 3.4 million Americans a year. It's like suicide. We tend to focus on the 349 active component service members that committed suicide last year. We don't talk about the 38,000 Americans who committed suicide last year. So these are not just problems that are experienced by servicemen and women. They are problems that are associated with all of us, and we really need to really support research to move forward.
You mentioned the difference between how we look at service people and civilians. Post-traumatic stress, without the disorder attached, it has been recognized as the term by the military, but not, as I understand it, by the civilian medical establishment.
No, I made the argument in front of the American Psychiatric Association that I felt that it was a barrier to care. I was hoping that in DSM-5, which was just published within the last month, that they would change the name of it and drop the D and do what the Canadians have done in their military. They call it operational stress injury, but their decision was not to do that.
Did you imagine when you embarked on your career, you went through ROTC at Seattle University, that you were going to be working in the field of mental health?
Absolutely not. You know, it's really kind of amazing that I spent two tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and really didn't know what traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress was. It wasn't until the 4 years that I was vice chief of staff of the Army and responsible, along with the chief, for 1.1 million Americans that I realized what a huge problem this was and what little we knew about it. And to me, that's the really sad thing. We know so little about it. We say we're going to take care of these young men and women. But if you look at the dollars that we're spending to try to find answers to these, it doesn't add up.
We have been talking with retired General Peter Corelli. He's now CEO of a Seattle-based One Mind for Research. And as you heard him say, focusing on post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and the way it impacts us in our lives.
And all the diseases of the brain. We're focusing there now, but we will, in fact, tackle all the diseases of the brain.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. The sound of the day. Sounds like a movie theater, doesn't it? It's the sound of a 35-millimeter projector the day before it was dismantled to make way for a new digital cinema projector, which is the industry standard. That sound was sent to us by Alice, who's executive director of the Pickford Film Center in Bellingham. They're sad up there to say goodbye to celluloid film. That projector has been reliably showing movies since the 1920s. I don't know that digital projectors make any sound.
I was just wondering about that.
If you have the sound of a digital projector, send us that sound or whatever you're listening to. Record 30 seconds, and you can send it to us along with the story behind the sound. Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line.
Maybe Robert Horton knows the answer to that question.
And he's coming up, so I better prepare him right now. Robert, go out and record
that. Go
do some research for us.
All right. Thank you, Marcy. Weekday continues in just a few minutes. Bunch of new orders for Boeing today, but a smaller plane maker is also seeing a surge. We're going to find out what's behind Bombardier's popular turboprop in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Virginia Mason's.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.